It's the Wiggin Sessions, a show where key thinkers and industry pioneers discuss politics, economics, philosophy, and history. Big ideas impacting the economy, the financial markets, and our lives. Here's your host, Addison Wiggin.
Hello, welcome to the Wiggin Sessions, episode 16. I'm your host, Addison Wiggin. Recently, I interviewed my good friend Jeff Dice, the former chief of staff of Congressman Ron Paul and current president of the Mises Institute in Auburn. In this session, we dig into the Mises Institute and Austrian economics, mergers and acquisitions, which was Jeff's former career. No turning back on the national debt, spend, 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 modern monetary theory, monetary policy, and stimulus for neo-Keynesian economics. And then we talk a bit about China taking over the reserve currency. Not so fast. Ready? Let's jam. Hello, welcome to the Wiggin Sessions. I'm your host, Addison Wiggin. Today I have with me Jeff Deist, who was, when I first met him anyway, and I'll let him give his own background, but when I met him, he was the chief of staff for Ron Paul, and we used to go down for the Liberty Caucus meetings and have chats with the different representatives and that kind of thing. So welcome, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Addison. It's great to see you.
You are currently the president of the Mises Institute. We'll get into that in a minute. I'd like to hear your perspective on how we met, and then I actually want to give you a very warm compliment because you did something that I thought was gentlemanly, which is uncommon in our times. But when Dr. Paul decided not to run for Congress again, but instead he left to pursue the presidency, you made a commitment to your staff that you would find everyone a job. You made that commitment and you told me that. And one of your staff members ended up working for us and became a very good publisher at Agora. And I want to commend you for making that commitment. I know that you thought that was very important. I don't know how many, you had like 8 or 9.
I'm sure that was you know, Ron was helping people get jobs, definitely. But, you know, if you recall back to those days, we actually had a connection with you and Bill Bonner and Agora because of the Daily Reckoning and because of the book and I guess also the film Empire of Debt. So those are kind of old days now. That almost seems quaint today, considering the debt. It does seem quaint, but I think that's how we originally came to know both you and Bill Bonner.
Yeah. Well, that's why we came to the meetings in the office. And that's how we got to know each other, because we were trying to like sort out the debt and everything. But maybe a good way to start is just to ask you, what was it like in those days? And what's your perspective on the debt these days? Because it's crazy.
It's pretty shocking to think that the good old days were when all we had to do was worry about the Patriot Act and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And, you know, $12 trillion of debt or whatever. It's pretty remarkable. I mean, here's an anecdote. We didn't have social media so much when I was working for Dr. Paul. And since it's become such a huge phenomenon, I've noticed that not only do members of Congress, senators and representatives really snipe at each other in a cowardly fashion using social media, but I've also noticed staffers do it too. You know, staffers will snipe at a member of Congress or a senator. And I got to tell you just one thing about my time in working for Ron Paul was that the number one rule of working for a politician is you do no harm. You know, you never get them crosswise or in hot water with another member of Congress who would, you know, there's a pecking order and the members of Congress and the senators were way above us. And so when I see some of this stuff today, it's really shocking to me because I would never as a staffer have publicly issued some snarky comment about the way somebody else voted, you know. So things have really radically deteriorated in Washington, D.C. amongst the political class in just the, you know, 7 or 8 years since I left the Hill. And, you know, maybe that's a good thing because maybe we're seeing these mental invalids for what they really are. They're really a bunch of incredible mediocrities. I mean, just an unbelievable set of unimpressive people. People who, in many cases, couldn't run a small business or a Subway franchise whatsoever, but latched on to this bizarre world of politics. The other difference I'll note, and I know you asked me about the debt, but there used to be far more of a difference between a senator and a representative. The senators were generally wealthier. They had generally gone to more prestigious Ivy League schools. They were generally a cut above in terms of their intelligence, in their collegiality. And the whole atmosphere in the Senate was very different from the more politically charged atmosphere in the House. So that's something else that's fallen by the wayside. It was almost like the difference between federal and state judges on the judicial side. There used to be a real distinction between those. But now we see a lot more people going from the House to the Senate and winning election by being sort of acrimonious. And with not only the internet, but also social media making everything that senators do very public now, there's not much opportunity for any kind of backroom collegiality or the kind of slower pace, the more deliberative concept of the U.S. Senate that we used to have to act as a break, the really politicized and charged atmosphere in which we find ourselves today. So the Senate's gone. The House is an absolute clown show. The presidency is really the only game in town. The Supreme Court matters, I think, also. I think the Supreme Court matters more than Congress and the Senate, but really it's the not just the president, but the administrative agencies. What we saw with Trump is that being president isn't enough. You don't really control your own agencies. They have a life unto themselves. So you put all this together and you say, you know, what's going to stop Congress from racking up debt? You know, and the short answer is not much, and certainly not the Fed. So now we have this big round number in front of us, 30 trillion.
Yeah, it's crazy because when we were working together and when we were talking to Dr. Paul and we were putting out the film, we were worried about 10 trillion. And so, So we could get into this, but I actually want to ask a few questions that sort of get into your background a little bit. You worked with Dr. Paul for 2 years, and then you moved on, and you ended up being the president of the Mises Institute, which is an interesting organization in and of itself. So I do want to talk about that as well, but maybe you could talk about your background a little bit, just because I'm interested, because I haven't talked to you in maybe 3 or 4 years. So it would be good to hear how you've been doing.
Well, I mean, we're doing great down here. I wish the country were doing better. And in a sense, we're failing in our mission if the country is moving in a more statist or uneconomic direction, we might call it. Yeah. So I'm realistic about that. And I never lose sight of that. I was a lawyer for many, many years in the M&A space, so I saw a lot of the distortions caused by the Fed and low interest rates, a lot of distortions caused by big conglomerations of capital, which I don't think are actually market institutions. I don't think that all these wonderful hedge funds, and I don't think Goldman Sachs is particularly a creature of the market per se, but I think something that a lot of people don't understand is that the whole mergers and acquisitions business is really founded these days anyway on cheap debt. And the other twist is that when companies buy one another, they can deduct interest payments they make to banks, you know, on money they borrow to effect a merger or an acquisition. You can't deduct dividends. So as this became sort of a ubiquitous fact of life in the M&A world, and this really accelerated in the 2000s, the whole structure of our economy changed. And so when you have very, very low interest rates, an awful lot of people are trying to figure out what to do with their money because they're seeking yields, they're chasing yields. And you can't just go get a money market or a simple savings account at your bank or whatever. So I think that, you know, fuels a lot of what we see in M&A, because these companies, rather than actually becoming more productive and getting into new markets and developing new products and doing all the capital intensive things that perhaps people like you and I think they should be doing, they're really spending a lot more time engaged in a form of financial engineering. So a lot of my time in the M&A world really dovetailed with my existing, let's just say, jaundiced view of politics and central banking. And a lot of this stems just from my own father and older brothers who were interested in all this stuff when I was a young teenager. And also as a teenager, I was able to meet Ron Paul way back in 1988 when he ran for president. He came to a little Ramada Inn in Orange, California. I still remember that. So I've been sort of tangentially involved, peripherally involved in this sort of anti-Fed populist libertarian perspective for a long time, and then ultimately decided to get out of M&A for a while and go work for Ron in DC when you and I were more active, and probably thought that I would go back to that marketplace. But through Dr. Paul, I met Lou Rockwell, and just by hook or by crook, not really intentionally, I ended up coming down here to Auburn, Alabama, to the Mises Institute instead. So that's sort of the quick and dirty of it all. But everything we worried about, everything we used to talk about, everything Ron mentioned in those speeches about empire and debt and wars and the Fed, it's, well, first of all, it's all come true and it's all gotten worse in spades. But I think we ought to be fair to our critics and say, you know, it hasn't all come crashing down. People were talking about that way back in 1971. Doug Casey was talking about that back in 1971, that a currency untethered from any connection to gold or any kind of discipline would simply become a political currency and Congress would spend in a roundabout way because they issue treasury debt and the Fed sort of says, hey, if nobody else will buy it, we will. Don't worry. Wink, wink.
Yeah.
The whole thing's gone on a lot longer than we thought it could. And, you know, the timing of it, that's a valid critique of the Austrian or libertarian perspective. I think we should be honest about that.
Yeah. So how, after you left, well, you left the M&A space, and just to be clear for people who are watching or reading or whatever, M&A is mergers and acquisitions, which is a corporate structure that depends on debt, really, right?
These days, yes.
Yeah, these days. After you left that space, you after you had met Lou, you became the president?
Correct.
Of the Mises Institute. I'm going to ask two questions because I think that they're both important. One is, what is your role as president? But then the second is, I would like to hear your perspective on what the Austrian perspective is in the current environment.
Well, we are an academic institution, but we're really aimed at a lay audience. So that's what distinguishes us. We're not worried about public policy. We're not worried about trying to convince, you know, the UC Berkeley sociology department that Murray Rothbard was right and that feminists from the 1800s was wrong. So that's not our mission. Our mission is really to reach intelligent lay audiences, but also having an academic component. So, you know, not being an academic myself, not being an intellectual myself, I was able to come here in more of an operational role. And I had enough background in not only in Austrian economics, but also in just kind of the mechanics. I do a lot of fundraising. I do a lot of things with our website, a lot of outreach and marketing and programs and conferences and student things and a lot of public speaking and writing popular articles. So that's just kind of a very roundabout role, which was pretty good for me because I'm not, you know, again, I'm not interested in being a PhD in economics or anything like that. I'm interested in making concepts easy for people like me, lay people, to digest. And so when we look at the world today, I mean, we've got basically two kinds of economics. We've got what I would consider real economics, and then we've got the anti-economics, which comprises almost everything on the left, almost everything you hear from Paul Krugman, almost everything you hear from Keynesians, almost everything you hear from MMTers, modern monetary theorists, which is just a fundamental division in worldview. And I don't know how we reconcile them, which is why I'm increasingly interested in separating rather than trying to persuade. But this fundamental difference is basically is an economy based on production or consumption. You know, Jean-Baptiste Say, French economist way back when, came up with Say's Law and said, you know, the way you create a marketplace is through your own production. And by producing stuff, you have some money to go buy somebody else's stuff. And, you know, the idea that production precedes consumption was considered basically an axiom of economics well into the 20th century. And then John Maynard Keynes, who's been very, very successful and very, very influential, came along in the 30s with his general theory. And his book struck a nerve with a lot of people because there was a worldwide depression going on and people were looking for answers. And we always like answers which sound easy, right? We always like the idea that we can sort of commandeer or legislate our way to prosperity. And that's really what I would say demand side, stimulus side, Keynesian or neo-Keynesian economics is all about. It's about this idea that if we just sort of tickle people enough to want more stuff, and not just want it, but have the means through cheap money or cheap credit to get more stuff, then we don't have to worry about debt. Debt can just go up, 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 and people can buy more stuff, and that this is really the way forward. And so we don't need high interest rates to reward savers and people who accumulate capital. That's outmoded thinking. You know, these old Austrians used to think that businesses needed profits, and then they reinvest those profits into capital expenditure. And through these capital expenditures, they become more productive, meaning they get goods and services to us better, faster, cheaper. You know, that was all of a sudden became an outmoded view, what everyone used to think was common sense. And the idea was like, no, we need to stimulate. And so in the almost 100 years since the Great Depression, we have seen a very unholy mixture of stimulus, both on the fiscal side and on the monetary policy side. And, you know, today, Austrians are to an extent on the outside looking in. I mean, there are some good things about Austrian economics which have been incorporated into mainstream thinking. I still think a majority of economists would generally accept, for example, the Misesian or Hayekian critique of socialism and say, you know, full socialism, full social ownership of goods, of the productive factors isn't a good idea. But for the most part, I think that the loudest voices are those on the demand side. And I think their modern encapsulation is something which I just consider crazy, which is modern monetary theory. And MMT was basically an animating force in Bernie Sanders' two campaigns. And it's increasingly gaining traction on the left.
Yeah, which is, I just have a strange understanding because it just doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, the way I think about it is that you just print money into existence. Like, how does that work in the long term? Like, the money just ends up losing value year over year. And especially coming out of the pandemic right now, we've had disruptions in the supply chain and there's a ton of money out there. So what we're facing is inflation in every sector of the economy at the same time. And all that does is damage people's buying power, right? We're seeing it in every part of the economy right now. And still they're proposing trillions of dollars of spending. It's like they never went to school.
Well, look, what we've been doing is already a form of de facto MMT. Now, MMTers would disagree. Their program is simply this. Congress, through the Treasury, no central bank. Yes, you have a central bank in MMT land, but primarily Congress via the Treasury simply sets how much new money should be produced. Actual physical, you know, dollars and coins, but also electronic currency into people's bank accounts. And that as long as you're a sovereign currency, like the United States dollar, and as long as you're collecting taxes in that sovereign currency, you can basically expand the money supply indefinitely. And the only thing you have to worry about in terms of debt is if inflation goes up too dramatically, and then you pull some of that money back by raising taxes. And so if we look at the pandemic year 2020, for example, Congress only, or the Treasury only took in about $3.5 trillion, and it spent $7 trillion. So where's the difference? Well, the difference is that it issued Treasury debt and people continue to buy that even at very low interest rates on a 10-year, for example. But there was an implicit backstop provided by the Federal Reserve. Hey, guys, we'll buy Treasury debt from commercial banks, which they did once again during the repo crisis of 2019, what they did in spades following the financial crisis of 07 and 08. So it's not really a market for Treasury debt when you've got this enormous player, the Fed, saying, hey, guys, by the way, we'll buy it. Right. So this is more circuitous and roundabout than the MMTers would like. But in effect, I would argue it's very, very similar. So we're already basically operating on 50% clown land MMT. Half of what federal government spends, it doesn't raise in taxes. 2021 may be worse. We may see less than 50% of federal expenditures brought in taxes. So it raises the question, hey, Addison, if we can do 50% this way, why not 80%?
Yeah.
Why not 100%? Why are we having taxes at all?
So from a, that's what Stephanie Kelton is saying, right? We don't even need taxes. So from a perspective of having been in Congress, in Ron Paul's office in Congress, how do you make these arguments? Like, I felt like when I went down there that we were just a voice in the wilderness. Like, there's not a lot of people that listen to what I would call sound economic arguments. How do you actually approach that?
Well, that's a question for human nature. Does it take some sort of really nasty privation, a crash, a war, a famine, does it take something like that to sort of shake us out? Cicadas flying into your mouth and your hair.
Yeah.
That's just human nature. Do we require a shock to our system before we make change? And if there isn't any shock, will we just continue to sleepwalk in this way? That's probably true. I mean, let's not forget that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney back in the early 2000s, Dick Cheney was saying deficits don't matter. So we can't just blame Stephanie Kelton, who is the author of The Deficit Myth, one of today's leading proponents of MMT, a professor at SUNY Stony Brook. There's been plenty of MMT in effect on the right as well. And so I would actually blame the Bush administration as ushering in a true turning point. So I agree that 9/11 was a turning point for the United States in terms of our ability to argue about debt, our ability to bring any sort of coherent or rational argument to the question of spending and debt and entitlements, which are all, of course, interrelated. But if you look at that period, the early 2000s, when George W. Bush entered office, the debt was about $5 trillion, January 2001. So at that point, mathematically speaking, we still could have grappled with it, with spending cuts or taxes or selling off federal lands or something like that. I mean, it was still conceivable to deal with that. But then when a few things happened, first of all, there was a nasty stock market crash of 2000, 2001, which once again led Alan Greenspan and a few years later, Ben Bernanke to go into hyperdrive with respect to the Fed's balance sheet. Second was, of course, 9/11 itself, which sent us into, or at least gave us the supposed justification for two crazy wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all the spending that those entail and continue to entail, and all the VA spending that'll cost for decades going forward still. Then we had the big Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit, which was passed in a very unholy fashion, basically as a sop to seniors so that George W. Bush could beat John Kerry in that 2004 election. He had to give old people something to go vote for him. So when you put those three things together, I think that's when America really went around the bend. Think of somebody in a Porsche who is heading towards a cliff at a really fast rate of speed. There's some point at which they're too close to the cliff where no amount of braking or counter steering is going to get them out of that turn and they're going to go over the cliff. So I think somewhere between 2000 and 2004 was that moment for the United States.
Yeah. And then it continued, because then you have after it's crazy actually what happened after that. Then you have 8 years of Obama and you get Obamacare, and then you've got the crazy populism of Trump that just continued the spending. There's no political backstop to the idea that we can just keep spending our way to prosperity, which is just insane.
Yes.
So actually, that was one of the questions that I had put on our list to talk about is Murray Rothbard, who was one of the founders, right, of Mises Institute.
Yes.
He wrote a book about the old right. There was a time in our country when we had citizen representatives And they would go, they would be representatives for 2 years, 4 years, or whatever. We don't have term limits. But they knew that the laws that they passed or the spending that they put in place, they would have to deal with after they got out of office. But now we have a president who's been there for 50 freaking years. He's been in Washington for 50 years, and he's proposing, what, $6.5 trillion of spending? Like,
yeah,
the disconnect between the people who have to live with the machinations of government and the people who are in it is like, it's, I don't know, it's probably historic. If we look back in history, this is how empires decline.
Well, when you talk about politicians having to live with the machinations, I mean, look at the Social Security Act passed in the 1930s. I mean, it's just now, nearly 100 years later, reaching a point where, you know, the number of retirees relative to the number of workers paying in, you know, is just 1 to 12 or something. It's just crazy. So the people who passed that bill are several generations dead and gone. Yeah. And yet we're still paying for that today. So who knows what seeds we're playing today? I mean, Biden is not what people thought he was. He's not some good old boy from the Senate who's pretty moderate. He's really an empty vessel at this point, a scary guy. I think because he's just such a bumbler and because he has mental health problems, he comes across as perhaps less scary than he really is, but really bad guy. And I don't know where the political breaks will come from on spending and debt. Because as you mentioned, I mean, the populist right today is convinced that we need to spend money on things like childcare so moms can stay home and that sort of thing. You know, anybody who talks about the budget in real terms will immediately become a non-entity in politics. Because if you're talking about spending, the only things are the Defense Department, in other words, War and Peace, Social Security, and Medicare. At the federal level, if you're not talking about cutting defense, Social Security, and Medicare, you're unserious. And talking about cutting any of those is basically a death sentence for any national politician. So that's on us. That's our fault for allowing this environment, you know, where everyone's just become such a greedy, you know, such a greedy little you know what. I mean, I think back to Hunter S. Thompson writing about Nixon. And just the sort of greed of that era and the unpleasantness of Watergate and how it really changed DC. Well, that all looks pretty quaint compared to today. I mean, there's a whole generation of baby boomers who I think is basically just, hey, as long as Social Security lasts until my last breath, you know, that's good enough. If there's one thing governments and central banks do on a cultural level, a social and cultural level, forget the technical stuff, forget the economics, is they encourage us to live today at the expense of tomorrow. And that flows throughout society in ways we can't even begin to understand or see. It's the job of economists, by the way, to make the unseen visible to us. When we give some guy who's, you know, 72 years old, he has a house in Florida, he has some stocks and bonds, he has an IRA, you know, his net worth is, you know, $3 million. He's not a super rich guy, but he's comfortable. Well, when we give that guy $2,400 a month or whatever in Social Security, you know, how does that affect his behavior? And how did it affect his behavior for the couple decades before, knowing that he was going to get that $2,400 a month? Did he buy a Mercedes every 5 years instead of a Honda Accord? You know, did he travel on French river cruises instead of just going to Disney with his grandkids? I mean, it flows through society in so many ways. And there's so many layers to the onion that, you know, people like us, we have a tough road in front of us to make all this somehow understandable and visible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're talking about is the seen in the unseen, which is a famous phrase from Bastiat, who was trying to convince the French Empire that they were spending their way into oblivion in, what, 1837 or something? And look what happened. Well, they ended up with Auguste Comte.
Yeah.
It is socialism.
Yeah. There's actually a great French economist and a great French, you know, real liberal tradition. So I'm not a French basher. I'm a pro.
Oh, yeah. Neither am I. I'm a Francophile for sure. I love their culture. I just don't like the French.
Yeah.
Although I shouldn't say that out loud because my friend Olivier would get really upset.
Well, can we have Frenchness without French people? I'm not sure. But it is interesting when you bring up populism and France, you know, they have their own very serious problems with, you know, there's a lot of people who don't like the Islamic immigration. There's a lot of people who do. They have kind of a real split in their right wing with leaders like Le Pen, who are sort of France's version of Trump. And they have Macron, who's trying to be France's version of Biden, I suppose. It's interesting to watch some of this stuff play out in a smaller country than our own, because you can take lessons from it. But they have their own huge problems with entitlements and debt. And unlike us, they don't have their own currency. You know, that is really a cautionary tale. When you accept control over your currency, and I would say in many ways, we've given up control of our own currency to political forces. It really radically changes things.
Let's talk about China for a bit then, because that's one of the ways that we're giving up control is if we're this is what it seems like Biden's up to, is beholden to the Western European structure, right? The Chinese, they're like, we don't care about that. And so they're a little bit, well, they're ascendant for one. I think they're a little bit confident that they can, even their currency or the cryptocurrency that they're trying to develop can unsettle at least the dollar as the reserve currency, which is what the entire financial structure of Western Europe is dependent on.
Well, there's a lot of parts of the world have a vested interest in unseating the US dollar as the world's reserve currency. There's no question that Brazil, India, Russia, China, the BRICS, so-called, all have an interest in that. The flip side is that at least in the short term, they own enough dollars themselves that they don't want a rapid devaluation. So it's a little bit of a catch-22 or a whipsaw even. And that's, you know, I've tried to read as much as I can on China. It's sort of beyond my understanding. I don't know if they're a paper tiger. I do know that they're more confident than us. I do know that they view 240-odd year America as a startup. In the Chinese, we're like still a gnat or something like that. And so if we're weak geopolitically, why wouldn't other countries celebrate that? I mean, we were the bully of the 20th century, and there's nothing more imperialistic than the US dollar. That's been a tool of imperialism, especially in the Middle East. My God. Our footprint is everywhere. We have military bases everywhere. We finance all this with debt, and other countries sell us cheap $6 flip-flops at Walmart. You know, pretty good deal for us, because all we're giving them is these silly green things, and they're giving us an actual pair of flip-flops. But, you know, I'm not smart enough to say how long it can go on. I mean, maybe it goes on past my lifetime, but I got a couple kids, so that's my focus.
Yeah. Well, that's how I feel too. All right. Well, that sounds like a good place to wrap it up. Focus on your kids.
Yes. And I'll go really contrarian and say have some kids. I think there's a hubris where we think we live in the most, you know, the age of the most advanced change and the most dynamic time.
Yeah, the end of history theory.
Yeah. And, right? You know, look at our ancestors who lived through the Great Depression, a couple of world wars, the Civil War, all this stuff. I mean, I think of my own great grandmother, whom I knew barely. I mean, I have very faint memories of her. I think she died when I was 5 or 6. You know, what my great grandmother saw in her lifetime was basically electricity and indoor plumbing coming into being, and then automobiles, and then airline travel. And then towards the end of her life in the 70s, she got into computer, you know, she saw computers and the man on the moon and all that. So I would argue that her generation saw more rapid change than ours.
Yeah, it's probably true. And we're just going to have to deal with social media for now.
Yeah, exactly.
Good to talk to you, Jeff.
Thank you, Addison.
That was Jeff Deist. He's the president of the Mises Institute. You can follow Jeff at the Mises Institute at www.mises.org.